Hi, everyone. Welcome to Education for Sustainable Democracy. My name is Brett Levy, and I'm a researcher of civic and environmental education. It's great to have you back for another episode. In today's media environment, there's no shortage of information and misinformation. So how do we know if we're being misled? How can young people know? The ability to tell fact from fiction is vital for maintaining a healthy civil society, and researchers are exploring how to teach these skills. On this episode, I speak with Sarah McGrew, a cutting-edge researcher in this area. After earning her PhD at Stanford in 2019, she joined the faculty at the University of Maryland, where she has several ongoing studies about fostering students' media literacy. Please stay tuned to hear about her research, key findings, and practical ideas that educators and parents can use. If you're new to this show, welcome, and please be sure to subscribe. This show has dozens of other episodes, and you can find them on the feed or at www.esdpodcast.org. If you like the show, please be sure to share it with a friend. Thank you so much for all of your support. Now, here's my conversation with Sarah McGrew. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm wondering if we could start by just getting an overview of your research on media literacy education. What are the major questions that you've been exploring over the last few years?
Sure. So at a really broad level, I study how students evaluate online information, mostly middle school, high school, and college students, and then how teachers can support students to learn more effective evaluation strategies. I'm at University of Maryland now, but my research in this area started with the Stanford History Education Group back 10 years ago now, like late 2014, looking at pretty large scale studies of how students at various ages evaluate social media posts or search for information online on different social or political topics. So we started getting a pretty good picture of some of the struggles that students have when they approach evaluating online information. And then started also turning to, as we continue to collect evidence about how students evaluate information, looking at, okay, if students are struggling in some pretty specific ways, how can teachers support them to learn more effective evaluation strategies? So as we were identifying, you know, more effective strategies, we started working with teachers to design interventions, classroom interventions that would teach those strategies, again, with mostly high school and college students. So that's really broadly kind of where my focus has been and where it continues to be.
So how did you become interested in this line of research?
So I was a high school history teacher, and I taught at a school for public policy, so a school that tried to build on the ways that students were already civically engaged and to help them, you know, build political knowledge and skills and get involved in their communities. So I was teaching modern world history, but spending a lot of time thinking about how the skills that I was teaching in my history classroom, you know, sourcing and contextualizing and corroborating really close historical reading, could support students in other parts of their lives, especially their civic lives. So I was really interested in what does sourcing look like when we're, you know, looking at media outside the classroom. So I went to grad school with those questions and then met Sam Weinberg, who was my advisor, who was getting really interested in the internet and how, what does it look like for students to make sense of information in this like wild and crazy place that is the internet. So we started working together in this area and really haven't looked back.
Well, it's such an important area of research right now. In your view, what have been some of your most important findings so far in your research?
The first one I already mentioned, I think, is just that young people need more support learning to effectively evaluate information. You know, I think now, and perhaps growing even more so, we assume that because young people, you know, grew up with these devices, because they are so quick and agile with them in some ways, right? They're like really quick at texting and switching apps and, you know, figuring out tech stuff, that they're good at also reasoning about the quality of the information that they're encountering in those spaces. And we just have tons of evidence at this point that that's not the case, that unless young people have received explicit, up-to-date instruction, they probably need more help. And that I think is an urgent and empowering message for teachers to hear, right? Because again, I think teachers can get intimidated by their students seeming tech savvy, and to learn like, okay, these students actually really do need my support, and I need to prioritize teaching this in my curriculum. And then secondly, we're sometimes still teaching really outdated strategies. Like the internet has changed so quickly, you know, we just have been talking about that, that it's really hard to keep up. It's hard to keep up as a teacher who's doing a million other things and is not necessarily an expert themselves in, you know, digital media literacy. But then on the optimistic side, like when we teach up-to-date strategies, students learn and they get better. So when we, again, take time in our curriculum to teach these skills explicitly and give students opportunities to practice, they do learn, which is, of course, encouraging and what we want to find as education researchers.
So one of your big findings is that students need much more support in their navigation of online resources. I'm wondering if you could help the listeners really wrap their minds around some of the big ideas that you've uncovered. Lateral reading is a really big one. I'm wondering if there are other big take-home messages from your research that would help educators, administrators, parents, and others listening to understand what we need to do. Like, what are the skills that we might not be thinking of that could really help students to navigate online information better?
Sure. So, and I'll get into a little bit more specifics about what students tend to do first, too, because that might be helpful. So we know without instruction, students tend to rely on these kind of like outdated approaches, what I've called weak heuristics or like weak shortcuts for evaluating information, like looking at the top level domain, assuming that a .org site is more reliable than a .com site, even though there's no difference between those sites anymore. Or assuming that a site, you know, that's nicely designed is more reliable than a site that has really basic design. Again, totally meaningless in the internet that we inhabit today. And then have learned things like, oh, I can just really carefully read the content of a site and evaluate, you know, how much evidence there is or whether it links to credible sources. And things like that really only work if we're experts in what we're evaluating, which most of the time when we're on the internet, we're not. So we have the situation where, you know, students are using some of those approaches, and we were seeing that, you know, with lots and lots of students across the country. And we realized we didn't know what it looked like to be really good at evaluating information. So Sam Weinberg and I designed this study where we compared how three groups of people who we thought might be really good at evaluating information did different tasks where we asked them to search for and evaluate online information. So we looked at a group of Stanford freshmen, so, you know, students who got into this really challenging university where computer science is the most popular major and, you know, in the heart of Silicon Valley, a group of professional historians, university-based historians, history professors, and then a group of professional fact checkers. And we sat those people down in front of computers and asked them to think aloud as they searched for and evaluated online information. And it turned out that the fact checkers were routinely and reliably really excellent at those different tasks. And the students and the historians actually often struggled in some of the ways that I already named. Like they engaged in carefully reading websites before they had any idea what the source was or where it was coming from, or sort of made judgments based on those weak heuristics that I mentioned, like the appearance of a site or its links. Fact checkers, on the other hand, did what we came to call lateral reading, right? Before they invested any time in a site that they didn't recognize, they left the site, opened new tabs on that lateral or horizontal axis, thus lateral reading, and searched for more information about the source from other websites. And they used sites including Wikipedia, a site that we continue to often tell students never to use, and just to get a quick sense of what that source was, whether it was a fair broker of information, whether it was worth investing more of their time in. So lateral reading helped fact checkers, again, like really efficiently decide whether to spend time with sites or whether they should just move on. So lateral reading was really big, and fact checkers used it routinely. Another strategy that we saw them rely on, we called click restraint. This is a strategy on search results where, again, students and sometimes historians would sort of quickly click on the first or second search result without voicing much reasoning about why they were clicking where they're clicking. And we know from lots of research, other research, that people often assume that search results are ranked in order of reliability, that the search engine's just serving up the best result for you first. And that's, of course, not true. And click restraint helped fact checkers, you know, slow down on search results, spend time looking at the different results, looking at the URLs and the titles, and making a wiser decision about where to click first.
Mm-hmm. Those are two really great strategies, I think, for young people and really everybody who's going to be finding information to develop.
Yeah, they're very concrete. Sometimes I do presentations or talk to folks and they're like, oh yeah, I do lateral reading without knowing I'm doing lateral reading. But like having mm-hmm. a name for it helps me teach it, right? Like helps to make it concrete and to say like, okay, we're going to do some lateral reading now. We're going to practice some lateral reading. And the lessons that we designed do exactly that. Like the teacher does some cognitive modeling, you know, shows, demonstrates for students how to read laterally, and then just has students do some guided practice and talk about what they find as they read laterally.
Mm-hmm. I think lateral reading has gotten a lot of traction because it's something that a lot of people can relate to and is pretty easy to connect back to sourcing, which is something that a lot of history teachers have learned about. You know, what is the source? What is the reliability of it? When it comes to click restraint, it reminds me of what I saw in your bio about the idea of search mastery. You're working with a group that is focused on search mastery. Is that right?
Mm-hmm, that's right, at University of Maryland. Yeah.
Yeah. Could you talk a bit about that and what search mastery is and a little bit about what click restraint within that might mean for young people looking for information about a particular topic?
Yeah, so the Search Mastery Group is a collaboration with colleagues in different units at University of Maryland. So some colleagues in the School of Journalism and some colleagues in the our College of Information Studies. And we're sort of trying to respond to this need that we see primarily in the undergraduate population here at Maryland, but also even in graduate students where, you know, they come to our classes and haven't necessarily learned before in high school about effective search strategies or evaluation strategies. So we designed these sort of modules that could be delivered asynchronously that would teach what we call search mastery, but is really just like a fancy name for being able to effectively search for information on the open internet. So often mm-hmm. colleges, you know, use librarians to teach how to search library databases, but we neglect mm-hmm. teaching how do you search on the open web, which is, of course, where students are spending most of their time when they're not in school. So the modules teach click restraint, teach students how search results are constructed to the extent that we know, and help them think about, you know, not just quickly clicking on that first result, but taking a little bit more time. And then also thinking about other aspects of the search results page, like the knowledge panel, like that panel on the right that comes up if you search for, you know, certain people or organizations with information about it, or direct answers, you know, when you ask a question or search something fairly popular and the search engine, you know, populates an immediate result, helping them sort of just think more critically about how those things are constructed and mm-hmm. learning that they cannot just automatically trust what the search engine is popping out for them. Mm-hmm. And then we also teach things like, you know, effectively using search terms and operators to narrow and specialize their searches. And then we teach lateral reading so they know how to evaluate sites that come up in their search results if they're unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, just like my other research in the past has shown, like we have quite a bit of evidence that without instruction, middle school, high school, and college students need a lot more support in this area. And that's been true at Maryland as well. So, you know, we have some initial evidence that the search mastery modules make a difference.
Mm-hmm. So I've been to the Civic Online Reasoning site a number of times. That's on the Stanford site. I'll put a link in the show notes for all of the listeners. That provides resources for teachers to learn about lateral reading and many other things. And it's publicly available, which is great. What about modules on search mastery? Is there anything on that publicly available?
So it's not publicly available now because it's housed within our learning management system, unfortunately. Mm-hmm, but we're mm-hmm. certainly thinking as a group about ways to make it more publicly available. And some members of our group are even working with public librarians in the area to make those resources available to them. But it's unfortunately not publicly available yet.
Mm-hmm. So were those the main two things that you saw fact checkers doing better than historians and undergrads? Lateral reading and click restraint?
Yeah, exactly. Those are the things, really like powerful, efficient strategies. And the point that I haven't made yet, but I will say is the reason that those work so well is that they were not only effective, but they were really efficient strategies. So if we think mm-hmm. about like the internet is sucking up a lot of our time and attention. And that's one of the primary costs that we pay when we're on the internet. And lateral mm-hmm. reading and click restraint require an initial investment of time, but over time actually, you know, save us that time and attention because they help us direct our attention to resources that are actually worth our time.
That's an interesting way of looking at it.
I emphasize the efficiency because I think when people initially learn about lateral reading, they're like, oh, I'm never going to take the time to do that. Like I'm never, that's too much effort or that's too much time. But actually, once you learn to do it, it saves time.
I could see that it would save time if you're a student and you're trying to look for information for a paper, then you're going to get good information as opposed to writing about bad information and then getting redirected by your teacher and then having to restart the project again. Is that how you're thinking of it in terms of saving time?
Yeah. And again, like the if your strategy is either like I'm going to read laterally and do this quick check, or I'm going to read the article really carefully and try to judge for myself whether it's credible based on its URL or how much evidence it presents. But like that is actually that kind of close reading is pretty inefficient, especially if you don't know if the source is a fair broker of information in the first place.
Right. So then you're using so much cognitive energy to interpret the information, but you don't have the background knowledge to really know. So you're just kind of making a lot of hypotheses and guesses. And that's a lot of mental energy as opposed to open up a new browser tab, see if, you know, John Doe is a reliable source and, you know, go from there.
Right. Exactly.
So often when people think about misinformation and disinformation, they're thinking explicitly about political information. That's probably true for a lot of the listeners, as well as us, since you and I, you know, came up through social studies education. But one of your recent studies explores how students in biology classes can learn to evaluate science-related information. Could you share your thoughts on why this type of skill development should happen across the curriculum? Why should media literacy skills be taught across the curriculum? And how does it fit within curriculum standards in various subject areas?
Yeah, great question. I think, you know, this digital media literacy teaching online evaluations does fit really well in social studies for the reasons you mentioned, and especially because we see that real civic goal, right? That like, in order to be a competent, knowledgeable citizen in today's world, you need to be able to decide what to trust online. I feel very confident saying that. And so social studies classrooms with their civic missions, I think absolutely play a key role in this. But the problem of online misinformation and the complexities of the internet are tremendous. Like the problem is so vast that the more introduction and practice that students have to these skills, I think the better. So the more that they can be introduced to them across the curriculum, it just takes some of the weight off social studies teachers and it helps ensure that students are encountering this in multiple classrooms. I think it's good for students to have messages reinforced. So in the study that you mentioned, Joel Breakstone and I worked with these ninth grade teachers, a team of ninth grade teachers, primarily world geography and biology teachers. And they said like, okay, we're going to focus in the ninth grade on teaching lateral reading. And we're going to, you know, both of these different classes are going to teach lateral reading lessons. We're going to use the same vocabulary. We're going to hang up lateral reading posters in our rooms. So students are going to hear about lateral reading, you know, in multiple classes. And that's powerful for, you know, students, not only because they get twice as much exposure, but because their teachers are sharing similar messages. You know, like when I was teaching and trying to do cross-curricular projects, I remember, you know, students would like perk up and be like, wait, you're talking to my other teachers? Like their minds were always blown when they realized that teachers actually talk to each other and collaborate. And I know a lot of schools aren't set up very well to make that easy for teachers, but to the extent that they can, I think it can be a really powerful learning experience for students. And then finally, it provides opportunities for students to evaluate sort of content specific information and to learn about who sources of authority are in different subject areas. You know, so if I'm in a science classroom evaluating misinformation about vaccines, for example, then I can learn, you know, oh, who's the World Health Organization or who's the CDC? And they can start to build that content knowledge about like when I have a question in science, who are some of those reliable sources I can turn to? And that's, of course, different than like who's a reliable secondary source in history? Who can I turn to if I have a social studies or historical question? And in order to build that knowledge, we have to teach lateral reading and quick restraint and these other skills across subject areas.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are the best ways to teach young people or even adults how to evaluate or approach information online? Is it through modeling or are there other strategies? You have a series of modules on some of these. I'm wondering if you could talk about what's in the modules.
Yeah, I think it does take a sort of modeling and guided practice approach where we're, you know, explicitly showing students or people, adults, what it looks like to engage in a strategy like lateral reading. And then, you know, giving them opportunities to practice lateral reading with some kind of scaffolding, you know, like with guiding questions or things to think about while they're reading laterally, just as they start to learn the process. And then having discussions about, like, what did we learn about the source? Where did we learn those things from? You know, what lateral sources did we use? And how credible did we ultimately decide that this thing was? And then as we're sort of teaching lessons like that, slowly building in explicit instruction in some elements of lateral reading that we know take a little bit of time to learn. And those include things like, what are those credible sources I can turn to when I'm reading laterally? Like, I could use Wikipedia. I could use stories from news organizations. I could use stories from fact-checking organizations, but explicitly introducing those resources to students. And then explicitly countering some of those weak heuristics or problematic strategies. So saying, you know, you might have learned in the past that a .org website is more reliable, but that's not true anymore. We're not going to use that anymore. We're going to read laterally instead. But having those conversations as part of the lessons. So those are just a couple of, you know, mini lessons that we can build into this sort of larger structure of modeling and guided practice and discussion that the lessons take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds really great. It sounds like there are a lot of ways for students to learn lateral reading and click restraint. I'm also wondering about how teachers, in your view, should address the issue of students coming to the classroom with misinformation and having some of that misinformation deeply embedded in their thought processes. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
With this? Yeah. Like, people sometimes believe in conspiracy theories, and people are exposed to lots of misinformation before they might come to a 10th or 11th grade class where they learn lateral reading and click restraint. What should a teacher do in that situation?
Yeah, so first I will say it's such a personal situation and it's so contextual. Like, I think, you know, how safe the teacher feels in their school and how, you know, yeah, their knowledge of the student and the student's family. Like, I can't give blanket advice on a question like that. Right. But I think, you know, in the sort of like innocuous kinds of misinformation, you know, where students come in and are like, oh, I saw this thing on TikTok last night. I think that's a great opportunity for a teacher to say, like, okay, let's pull that up. And like, let's read laterally as a class about it, you know, instead of the regular warm up, mm-hmm, like, let's spend 5 minutes right, just trying to figure this out. And again, sort of bridging that home school or, you know, inside outside school divide for students so they can start to see how what they're learning in school is applicable in their lives outside school or the time they spend on social media. I think for more ingrained things like conspiracy theories, like you're mentioning, obviously, like, that's a riskier move. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I have done some work starting last year with teachers trying to think about how to engage students in evaluating information on topics that they care about and mm-hmm, asking them to kind of reflect on their initial reactions to posts or, you know, like, okay, you see this, do you want it to be true? Do you think it's true? Like, based on what you already think. So asking mm-hmm them to do a little bit of reflection and then engage in some lateral reading about the source of the claim and then sort of return to that reflection. Like, did what you thought at first when you first saw the post match what you learned when you read laterally, and helping students think through that. Mm-hmm. So it's just meant to kind of slow down the process mm-hmm so students can hopefully engage in a more, you know, cognitive, rational fact-checking instead of just relying on their initial reaction to something.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great. I think this idea of evaluating information together is an interesting idea, and it really does require a teacher to shift from the role of authority figure to the role of information media literacy guide, which is potentially uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think it is uncomfortable. I think, though, with the teachers I've worked with who work in, you know, more politically contentious places, you know, like purple, purple places. I think in some ways that can be empowering, right? Because when you're talking about these potentially contentious issues, it removes the teacher as the like arbiter of truth and or the person who has to say like, you're right and you're wrong, or like you have the facts straight and you don't. But to say like, I'm not sure about that. Like, let's try to figure that out together and trying to help students build the skills that they need to do that work. And that sort of, you know, actually potentially, again, I completely agree that it's a place of real humility and even vulnerability for teachers. But on the other side, it also, you know, takes some of the risk off of them being the person, again, like I said, being the arbiter of truth in the classroom. So I think it can be really empowering for teachers at the same time, because they're helping students do the work for themselves.
It also models humility and uncertainty, which is something that we should have in this information age where there's a lot of information coming at us. And we really should question a lot of what comes to us and do lateral reading and do, you know, our searches appropriately.
Right. And I think, again, if teachers are nervous about the, like, listening to a student come in and say something and then just throwing it up on the board together, you can do something a little bit more structured, like make a homework assignment where students have to submit examples of online content that they've seen in their own feeds that they're not sure about or that they'd like to fact check. And then the teacher can review those and select a few to do together in class, right? But, like, gives the teacher a little bit more time to do some prep on their own, make sure the content's appropriate, but then still engage students in like, okay, whoever saw this on their social media feed, like, let's look at it together.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So your work's done an amazing job identifying problems and potential solutions. And your work with teachers has been innovative and effective in those contexts. But I'm wondering, broadly speaking, what large-scale efforts are underway now to address the fact that many young people accept misinformation and disinformation as truth?
Yeah, so I'll say first that I think this is a, it's such a big problem, and it's not just young people, right? In fact, it's like, it's all people in this environment that we've created. And I think responding to the scale of the problem is going to require responses from far more than educators, right? Like, this is a problem that requires change from technology companies and probably some government regulations, and also education, absolutely. And also some change in media organizations. So this is like, it's a huge problem, requires a huge solution. But in terms of education specifically, more and more states, I think, are sort of paying attention to this. And several states have recently passed laws requiring, and again, they're very different state by state, but requiring some kind of news or media literacy education for students. Those vary. Some of them require that at K-12, some just in high school. I'm cautiously optimistic about these laws. On one hand, I think it's great that there's more attention on these issues. And we know that if, you know, that teachers have tons of things to teach, right? They have too much to teach them, more than to teach than they have time for. So if there's some support from their state and encouragement from their state to teach media literacy, they may be more likely to spend time on these really vital issues. But at the same time, a lot of these are just mandates coming from the state and aren't accompanied by, you know, money for curricular resources and support for teachers. And without that, I just worry that teachers either just won't pay attention or will go looking for resources and find things that are outdated and not great, or might try to teach things and without much support, you know, just kind of struggle themselves. Because again, most people, if they haven't been taught really effective evaluation strategies, including teachers, aren't very good at evaluating information. I'd like to see these states provide, you know, more links to curricular resources, more support for teachers. But I think the laws is a great place to start.
I'm actually on a media literacy committee here in New York State, and we're trying to push legislation here that would be accompanied by some support.
That's great.
It's a multi-year effort that's been going on here, but you know, hopefully we'll get something through. I'm wondering what states, I believe Washington State has something. What other states have passed regulations in this domain to encourage teachers to teach media literacy skills?
Yeah, so New Jersey very recently passed a news literacy law. Illinois recently passed a media literacy law. Media Literacy Now is an organization that tracks kind of current policies, and they have a nice map on their website of the states that in the U.S. that have some kind of media literacy law. California recently passed a, a media literacy law. So there's progress. But again, all those laws need to be accompanied by actual resources and support.
Yes, yes. That would definitely make them more effective. So what is next for your research?
Last year, I worked with this team of high school teachers to think more about how to teach skills like lateral reading in ways that felt a little bit more authentic and relevant to students. So we spent more time teaching about online structures and how those influence the information that students are seeing day to day, especially in their social media profiles, and then engage students in evaluating information on topics that they said they cared about. So we asked students, like, what are the social issues that you care about in your communities? And then picked examples for them to evaluate on those topics, as well as spending some time in class just saying, like, okay, go on your own social media feed and find a post and, you know, read laterally about it. And then we'll come back together as a class and share some of those examples. And we did that work of engaging young people and thinking about, like, okay, what's my initial reaction to this post? Let me evaluate it. Or let me read laterally about it. And then let me reflect on my evaluation and how that compared to my initial reaction. So still in the midst of analyzing all the data from that study and trying to figure out what next steps are in terms of, again, you know, teaching young people in these sort of more authentic ways to evaluate information. I'm also just starting a project that's funded by the Department of Education, and that's a collaboration with the Office of the State Superintendent of Education in DC, which is the sort of it's DC, so it's the equivalent of the state or education organization. And the Close Up Foundation. And we're going to support eighth grade teachers in DC to teach what we've called digital civic inquiries. So we're going to teach young people to evaluate online information on political topics and then have them use the credible information that they find to engage in discussions and plan for action. So this is an attempt on my part to say, like, evaluating information is only one piece of this hopefully larger inquiry arc, right? Where you're, like, actually using the information that you find to do something or make a decision. And we need to actually help young people model that whole process in classrooms. So we're going to, you know, plan units on issues like affordable housing or gun control, you know, so students are learning to do that online research and then engaging in discussions with the information they find. So I'm really excited about that project, but we are just in the sort of beginning stages of curriculum development.
So they use the information for discussions or advocacy or both?
Both, ideally. It's going to, so Close Up Foundation does a lot of work supporting social studies teachers, especially to engage in, you know, deliberations with students. So their expertise is going to play a key role in, in helping teachers learn to facilitate discussions where students are bringing in information from their online research to engage in deliberations and then, do some at least planning for action, if not taking action themselves.
In both of these projects, especially the first one, I'm wondering what the role of metacognition might be. You said something about students thinking about their initial response to information and then their later responses to that same information. I'm wondering what you think about the role of confirmation bias and motivated reasoning, and how people can look at information that might challenge their prior conceptions of something and actually really be open to it and do some lateral reading there and maybe use some click restraint if they find search results that seem to initially confirm what they already think in order to really question their own perspectives on things.
Those lessons that I mentioned taught explicitly about motivated reasoning. We talked to students about what it was, and we said, like, okay, how do we counter motivated reasoning? Like, we can slow down, we can, you know, think about and gauge our initial reaction. We can remind ourselves that algorithms are putting information in front of us that we want to engage with, so we stay on the platform, right? This is not just neutral information that's coming to us. The algorithm is trying to manipulate us sometimes. So helping young people think about that and then build the motivation to take the time to do the lateral reading, even if they have a really strong reaction to the post. And again, it's just the beginnings of thinking about what this could look like. I think we don't have a great sense of what it looks like to help people overcome their motivated reasoning or whether that's right. even possible. But I think we have to start to have conversations in classrooms about this if there's going to be any hope.
I wonder if an awareness of motivated reasoning and an awareness of confirmation bias might actually help people to be more metacognitive about it. And maybe this is one of the things you could find in your research. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's the hope. And I mean, we'll see. There's certainly more to come. But I think some of it is just, and we made a point in teaching students, like, this is just the way our brains are wired. Like, this isn't something wrong with us. It's not, and it applies to everybody. Like, all of our brains are wired to make us want to believe information that meshes with what we already believe, right? Because it's just easier to live in a world like that. So yeah, we'll see if it helps just build awareness even, and if that makes a difference.
Yeah, well, I really hope it does, because I think that is a really important thing to address. These skills are so important to teach people, but also these mindsets could be really helpful for getting us out of our political tribalism and sectarianism that we have right now that is keeping us from really listening to each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there anything else you'd like the audience to hear about?
No, the last thing I would say is, especially for our audience of teachers, like, even if you're excited about this, but a little bit overwhelmed by the prospect of taking on teaching students to evaluate information, I would say that it's great even just to do it in small chunks, like, you know, spend 15 minutes at the beginning of one class modeling lateral reading, and then do it for a warm-up, you know, a couple of more times. This doesn't have to be like a 3-week long unit. It absolutely can be if you want it to be, but I think it's so critical that we start teaching these skills. And if the way that makes sense is to do it on a really small scale, then that's wonderful.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I really appreciate your work. It is so important and so powerful, and just keep it up.
Thanks. Thanks for having me today. It's been a pleasure.
That was Sarah McGrew, assistant professor at the University of Maryland, College Park. I hope the ideas in this show were useful for you. Please visit the show notes to learn more about Sarah, her research, and some of the other issues and resources that we discussed. And this is Education for Sustainable Democracy. I'm Brett Levy. This show's theme music was written by Keep Listen. To support the show, please subscribe to the podcast feed and like the show on Facebook. Links to those pages and to my open access articles are in the show notes. Also, if you're a teacher and are interested in teaching about the election, please visit my site on the topic, www.teachingelections.org. The site has engaging lesson plans and many other resources, so check them out. Thank you so much for listening and for all your support. And please stay engaged.